So let's think about the connections between the two parts. First of all, couple of things are in terms of the planning graph, the variations you've seen when you got to the stochastic planning, for example, is you needed to consider multiple planning graphs. You know, if you have state distribution, so if you have non-conformant sort of planning, if you have non-deterministic planning, you could be in one of many different initial states. And so you needed to consider multiple planning graphs, you know, from, you know, each of them. And again, we tried the dumb idea, which is just consider all of them. And then we tried a slightly smarter idea, which is have one structure which labels, you know, with labels such that you have a single skeleton planning graph which can essentially capture all the different planning graph, you know, the planning graphs corresponding to different worlds. Now, a nice connection between that and what we were doing in terms of classical planning was that when he talked about the state agnostic planning, which becomes essentially doing reachability analysis not for a single state. So we started for classical planning, single state, single initial state, multiple goal states. That's what the graph plan was, you know, the planning graph was doing. By the time you went to non-deterministic, you became multiple initial states, multiple goal states, and you extend it to all states, then you essentially have, in principle, a solution to a vexing problem in progression planning, which is you have to do multiple planning graphs, one for each of the states on the fringe. Okay, so that's kind of a connection in terms of going back from the stochastic side back there. The other thing that Dan was pointing out was when you went to quantitative probability, stochastic planning, you essentially could use samples and consider deterministic planning graphs corresponding to each of the samples. And the labels there were on the samples themselves, not on the initial states, but on the samples. So, and once again, I think the nice thing is you have the graded laziness that you can practice. I mean, you can have more samples versus less samples to increase the informedness of the heuristic. You know, if you spend more samples, then you get more accurate estimates. Okay, so that's some of the connections. Obviously, there are other details that are different because the problem itself is different. In non-deterministic planning and non-deterministic domains, the problem is more complex. Okay, now coming back to what I was talking about before we went off to the coffee break. We were looking at the partial satisfaction planning. I showed, I believe, one of these pictures here, and I said, if you remember, we are talking about a whole set of, you have set up end goals with utilities for them, and you have costs for the actions, and you're trying to find the optimal net benefit plan, okay? And I basically suggested that you could do this relaxed plan extraction which takes residual utility into account. So the idea is once you pick the first goal based on the best net benefit, then all the actions you committed to for that goal are now cheap. I mean, are basically zero cost for the other goals. They can be used again. So you want to take that into account in computing the net benefit of the remaining goals. Just to give an example of that with respect to the rover domain, simple example we had. So you have three goals, communicate soil, communicate rock, communicate image. So for each of them, suppose I have computed, so it turns out that my utilities for these goals, individual utilities are 50, 60, and 20. And then for each of them, I computed the relaxed plan, the best relaxed plan, cost-sensitive relaxed plan, and I subtracted the cost of that, and this is 25, this is 20, that's minus 15. So clearly you want to commit at this point to the communicate soil, which is the highest net benefit one. And now having done that, you now are considering, you're recomputing the net benefits for those two, communicate rock and communicate image, in the context of the actions that you already picked for this. And with respect to that, you again compute the net benefit if you add this goal versus add this goal, and this winds up being 45, that being 20, so you pick the communicate rock as the second goal. Now when you try to, the only other goal that you can add is communicate image. When you try to add, according to your estimates, the utility net benefit has reduced from 45 to 30. So you stop and you say, I'm going to just take those two. Okay. In this very simple example, you have actual optimal cost plans for each of the subsets of goals shown here. So these are the three goals, and for each subset of the, so if I pick just this, the top, the optimal plan would be 35 cost, the utility is 25, so the net benefit would be minus 15. So I actually showed you the real plans and real costs for the subsets here. Okay? That's not what I'm doing there, because when I'm doing here, I'm ignoring all the negative interactions. Okay? So it turns out that in this case, in fact, the best subset winds up being a communicate soil, communicate rock, whose cost winds up being 65, utility 120, net benefit 45, which in this particular case is essentially the same as what we got. We are not guaranteed to get the same exact number, first of all, and also sometimes you can actually get the wrong subset, but even ignoring the negative interactions here, you wound up actually getting the right subset. Now the one question one question that I mentioned earlier was, if you do have goals with negative interactions, okay, that means if you have actually of the end goals, there are mutual exclusions among them. So if you actually pick this goal, you can't pick another goal, because those two can't be achieved at the same time. Now, if you're ignoring negative interactions, you are likely assuming that all of them can be done in any subset possible. Okay. If you to take the negative interactions into account in the context of this sort of an idea, one thing you could do is the following. You notice that once you commit to a goal, then all its enemies can never, none of its enemies can ever get into the subset that you will grow, right? So now when you have mutexes, there is this question of, the goal that is the best individually, if you commit to it, then there are a bunch of other goals that you no longer can do, because they wind up being mutually exclusive with it, okay? One idea that you could try, and in fact it has shown benefit, is consider, essentially pick a set of initial starting goals, which are all mutex, okay? And parallelly consider what's the best you can do if you start with those and growing the subset. Okay, so if I have two goals that are mutually exclusive at the top level, at least, then I would consider committing to G1 and committing to G2 and seeing what is the best net benefit I can get with either of them and pick the one that's the best. Again, when I'm doing this, I'm doing estimates of the net benefit that I can capture. Now, as we are seeing this, you're kind of getting into the situation where picking the subset of goals is becoming more and more complex. In the beginning, you wound up actually having to consider residual utility. Now you're also having to consider negative interactions. And you continue, one of the issues is utility dependencies between goals. And the reason I'm doing this is I want to get you to see that in the end there is a canonical way of actually picking the best subset, which winds up putting all these little heuristics I'm throwing in a more systematic way. So to do that, let's look at the case where goals have utility dependencies. So that means if you have two goals, you can't just add up their utilities. Okay, and now when you have utility dependencies between goals, there's this question, of course, how do you specify it? You could consider there are many models for actually talking about modeling the interactions between the utilities of goals. For now, we'll assume that we'll use a notion of a generalized additive model where essentially you give the value of the utility value for all subsets of goals that do have interaction. Okay? And then when you have a set of goals whose combined interaction you're trying to find out, you find essentially the cover of that using the largest subset. okay, and then compute their utility. So if I have G1, G2 is 50, G3 is 7, and then if I have a set G1, G2, G3, I hit it with G1, G2, and G3 and add those numbers. So that would be my utility. Okay. So for example here, have left shoe, have right shoe, 500, have image, 150, and then have image plus have soil is 200 and so on. So you give values for subsets that actually have that differ from the independence assumption. Everything else is independent. Okay. Now, this is just the modeling aspect of the problem. Now, once you have this, things become, now we are still interested in figuring out which subset of goals should I focus on to get optimal net benefit plan. Okay, it's the same problem still. Except you are now have even more worries about committing to a goal upfront and then extending it by adding other goals because, you know, there are interactions between goals. Okay, so one idea is to consider this, is to consider a relaxed plan supporting the goals, all the goals, relaxed plan supporting all the goals that you have, all end goals that you have, and then trying to see, you know, which subset of it winds up having the best net benefit. Okay, so I would wind up having a relaxed plan supporting all the goals G1 to GN, and then if I now decide I don't want to support G2, I get to get rid of that branch in the relaxed plan. So I lose that cost, I lose that utility also. Okay, so I have one big relaxed plan and I'm trying to figure out which piece of it will wind up having the best net benefit. Now, of course, as I consider removing pieces of it, the utilities can go up and come down. Okay, I want to find the subset, the best subset that corresponds to the best net benefit. Now it turns out that this is a combinatorial optimization problem. You have a fixed length relaxed plan and you have only n goals and you are considering which subset should be the best. Okay, now you have the best, one way of doing it is to throw this as a integer programming problem. Okay, and now you notice that I am considering not the overall problem of what is the best optimal plan for best net benefit plan as an integer programming problem, but rather the heuristic aspect of it, just the subset, computing the subset as the integer programming problem. So the obvious question you should ask is, if you're anyway going to go suck up to integer programming, why can't you do it upfront? You know, why do you need to go through planning graphs and heuristic search? Why can't you just write optimal net benefit problem as a IP problem? We did. It doesn't work. In the sense, it does not scale anywhere near as well as heuristic search wants to. Okay? And just again, as I said, if you want to find the optimal, if you do a deterministic MDP and then find the optimal policy for that solves all these problems. It's just they don't scale that. Okay? So I wind up doing the IP for the heuristic. Now, the other interesting thing about this now is computing relaxed plans now are becoming more and more baroque. Okay, previously we started by saying, you know, have a single plan, single planning graph, and you just, you know, pick any action which supports somebody, and then, you know, you have a subgraph. And then I said, well, you can greedily bias it using a cost. Now I said, later on I said, well, the biases actually are connected to each other. So based on what you chose for goal one, the cost might reduce for goal two. Now we are saying, based on the subsets of goals you pick, the utilities would be different. So finally, now it's becoming actually a combinatorial search problem that you're, you know, explicitly modeling. So some work that was presented yesterday in a workshop by one of the students, Jay Benton, essentially considers, you know, it essentially models this problem of finding which subset, picking which subset will wind up giving the best relaxed plan fragment with the highest net benefit here as an IP problem. And you could write the constraints for that. So for each subset, if you pick this is the utility, and if you pick these goals, you would have to consider the actions for supporting them. They will become part of it, and so their cost would be added. Okay, this sort of winds up looking something like a SAT encoding, SAT encoding of plan. Okay, so except it is with respect to a single relaxed plan, rather than with respect to all possible relaxed plans. It turns out that then when you solve this, you will wind up getting the best fragment corresponding to the best subset, and then you focus on that subset of goals. Okay, by doing it this way, his heuristic computation cost increased about 200 times, and yet the overall benefit in terms of the overall time to get to the same quality was much better. Okay. However, if you actually did the entire thing using IP, that means you actually forget about this whole state search issue and just write this problem as, find me a 15-step optimal 15-step optimal net benefit problem when you have goal utility dependencies and cost dependencies, which is actually a very easy thing to do. It's just they don't scale that. Okay. So by the time you came here, relaxed plan extraction is now being done as something like satisfiability planning, you know, in this particular case, IP planning. Okay, and you're actually using combinatorial optimization approaches directly and just picking the best relaxed plan corresponding to the best net benefit. Okay, and then you're using that to do state search on the main. So these are kinds of pictures where I think essentially you're saying to reach the same net benefit, if you take that blue guy, of course, does this combinatorial optimization using IP, and the pink guy doesn't. And essentially, how much for the various problems, what is the quality they're able to achieve? And there's a variation of this, I think, probably in the previous one, which also talks about how fast are they reaching a certain net benefit level given the time. Okay, as you give more and more time, so for example, the blue one the pink one in this case, I guess they changed the thing. Pink became spud, and blue became the bad guy. And the pink one is reaching the higher net benefit faster with much less time, which is what you want. One thing that I want to mention, and I guess I brought this here, is you could actually see that having realized that it's essentially a combinatorial optimization problem, relaxed plan extraction is a combinatorial optimization problem. You could use greedy set techniques, or at some point of time you can say, well, I just do it using some systematic approach such as IP. Okay? So you could use this idea even when you don't have goal utility dependencies. If you just have cost dependencies, you can still use this. Okay, we haven't actually figured out whether it will pay its way through in that case. Okay. So that's regarding the partial satisfaction idea. Let me see where else I want to get to. This is, I guess, it's trying to get. What? We need to just pick something. Lower with power. Yeah, that's good. Okay. So a couple of things I want to do now. There's the PSP conclusion. If only I can keep it there. Okay. So the goal set selection essentially is what is the main issue for partial satisfaction problem. And I talked about how baroque it can get based on the interactions between the subplans for the goals as well as utilities between the goals. A couple of things that I want to mention is how planning graph heuristics can be generalized to handle resources and time. Okay, these I'll do somewhat fairly briefly because going into details especially for the temporal planning, it's not clear whether everybody understands the basics of temporal planning. So I'll at least give you, from the heuristic point of view, what changes happen to take resources into account and to take time into account. Okay. In the case of resources, the idea is essentially resources can be thought of as numeric state variables. So now the fluents are continuous values. Okay. And so different actions wind up increasing or decreasing the resource value. Okay. So you can obviously add for your rover, you basically wound up making, in this case, the power is the numeric value, and it requires certain power, and then it decreases the power based after the action. Okay. So as far as the relaxed plan problem, the planning graph heuristics are concerned, the question is, what do you wind up doing in terms of actually tracking the values of these variables? These are continuous valued variables, not true and false. Okay. When you had true and false, in essence, you wound up having both the true value and the false value at each level. You know, if you can reach P by level K, you would have P in level K. If you can also reach not P in level K, you would have not P too. Okay. So you could do something similar. You could say, if, again, a dumb idea, which is, suppose I discretize the continuous thing and say, if it's 1,000 possible values for the power, then I'll have 1,000 different variables, and then they can all be true and false, and so basically you can track it that way. Okay, a better idea which has been used by several planners is to actually keep track of the upper and lower bounds of the values that this continuous value variable can take. Okay, so what's the lowest value it can take by this level? What's the highest value it can take by this level? Now, the tricky point, of course, is it's possible that not every value between the lowest and the highest value are actually feasible by that level. But that's okay. That's what we're used to in planning graph. You know, if something is there, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's actually doable. If it's not there, it means that it can't be done. Okay? And so we can still guarantee that. We can say that if you are looking for a certain value of the resource by, you know, level 5, and if it doesn't fall in the interval, then you can be sure that you can't reach it. But if it falls in the interval, this is just an approximation. You may be able to reach it. Okay? So again, you're still keeping the optimistic projection. And keeping intervals is actually a way of keeping optimistic projection. And you want to be less optimistic and more accurate, you would start having to track disjunctive intervals over the resource value. Which is not bad. I mean, the advantage here is really you can decide how optimistic or how pessimistic you want to be in terms of tracking. I mean, these values. Okay, if you keep one interval for each continuous variable, that's the easiest thing to do. And if you are not getting enough accuracy on that, you can start having multiple sub-intervals. Okay. Now, if you're having one interval, it's easy enough to see what happens as you track them. You would consider among the actions that can change this particular variable at the previous level, what is the one that reduces it the most, and that will wind up having the effect on the lower bound size, and what's the one that increases the most, that will have effect on the upper bound size. Okay? And you propagate these things, and you know, in terms of the relaxed plan extraction itself, now, to reach a certain value of the resource, you might wind up having to support multiple actions which will get you to that, because it's possible that different actions give different levels of the resource, and you wind up having to have multiple supports just to have a certain level of resource. This is sort of similar to the thing that Dan was doing earlier in the non-deterministic planning, where to provide enough support, you might wind up having to have multiple actions. Okay, so these are not multiple disjunctive supports; these are multiple complementary supports. They all are needed to get this much resource by this time. Okay, so that's the other difference in terms of relaxed plan extraction for the resources. Now, if you want to do negative interactions on top of this, things are bad. Okay. Basically, you would actually have to, that's one reason why intervals will get partitioned out. Okay, if in fact certain pieces of the interval actually are not feasible because of the negative interaction between the actions, then you will start having to separately track them. But if you're ignoring the negative interactions up front, this is easy. Okay. That's just showing the relaxed plan extraction in this particular case. Okay. Again, the main point that I want, the one line that I want you to remember is keeping upper lower bounds on numeric state variables is very much consistent with optimistic projection. Not everything in that interval is actually feasible. But if you are not in that interval, then you are not feasible, which is the only guarantee planning graph ever made for you. Okay. It's a negative guarantee. And then again, as usual, handling negative interactions in the context of these is some more complicated. Similarly, handling negative interactions in the context of cost is also more complex. But I think one of the open issues in general for effective heuristics now that's left over is how to take negative interactions into account without going broke during the heuristic computation phase. Okay, those are still worth looking into in general. Yeah, there was a question somewhere?
You know, I'm not sure if it's general enough. I'll ask you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. The other thing that I want to say is how you do handle time with respect to this sort of planning graph, the planning graph based heuristic. Now, in a way, I would like to say easy, extremely easy, because the moment you realized that, no, I would not explain to you the temporal planning in itself, but the moment you realized that planning graph can actually be represented as a bi-level data structure, okay, where the one level essentially is the one level is the list of fluents, and the first index at which they come into the unrolled planning graph, and another is the list of actions, and they have an index which is the first index in the unrolled planning graph where they come in. Now, if you notice that in classical planning, these indices are all integral, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., corresponding to fixed level. Now, in temporal planning, they can be real numbers. Okay, in essence, an action comes in at 2.17 time, and then it has a deterministic duration of 3, so its effect come in at 5.17 time. Okay, and if this particular fluent can come either at 5.17 because of this action and 3.17 because of this action, then it's actually come in at 3.17 first. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you can draw unrolled planning graph in temporal planning. It looks actually ugly, you know, because you have the actions being stacked at irregular points. But if you think in bi-level planning graph description, then it's actually much more natural because the indices become the time points. Okay, and there was actually a question I think Hector had, and he ran away, but the question of how does, you know, if you can use time, I mean, you can model time as cost versus cost as time. What are the possible advantages, disadvantages? One interesting thing is we are actually here modeling time as the level. Okay, you could have modeled time as cost. Okay, but what happens then is if you do model time as cost, cost can be combined in multiple ways. You can consider, you know, independent combination by summing them up versus taking max and so on. But times, it makes, there are only some reasonable ways of combining time. Okay, the make span is a usual reasonable way to combine. Okay, so you would always consider max heuristic. And you are, if you kind of wind up thinking time is cost, then the only thing you'll consider is the max over the precondition time. So that's a way of connecting up time and cost. Okay, but I think a more natural way of handling time is that they change the indices of the actions and the propositions to be non-integral. They don't correspond to discrete proposition list, but they can come in at any real value time point. Okay. Again, these are curves showing that actually using these kinds of heuristics do improve temporal planners. SAPA was basically doing a progression search in the space of progression search in temporal planning, okay, which in itself is quite an interesting issue as to how to do it, but I won't go into it right now. And it uses that sort of temporal planning graph to figure out how far are you from the goal state in terms of time. And then, now one of the interesting things that SAPA did, and this actually gets me to the last part of the talk, which is in the context of temporal planning, you have duration, you have cost. Now, what are you supposed to be optimizing? Both. It's actually a multi-objective optimization problem. Okay? So graduate students optimize the cost aspect of the travel planning. Really rich industry people optimize the, you know, mix and aspect of their travel plan, don't care about the cost aspect. And most normal people try to get an optimal, a reasonable break between both. Okay. So in general, you have two different optimization objectives. Once you get to temporal planning with cost sensitive, you know, with non-uniform cost actions. Okay. So now what you wind up having to do is you are estimating the cost using the cost matrix that I, you know, on the same planning graph, you are propagating costs using the ideas of cost propagation that we talked about. You are also propagating time using the level information. And then, let me see if I can get you to there, if I can. Yeah, this is basically, this is the idea of hybrid models, but, yeah. So, in a case like this, you essentially have, this was a problem where you are trying to travel between two different cities and you have multiple travel actions. They have different durations and different costs. And so, you're trying to track cost as a function of time, actually. Okay? And it turns out that for, you know, in this picture, what we are showing here, I'm sorry, this picture what you're showing is cost of the literal being at LA is given by this cost function. Notice that it keeps changing as the time goes on. In a classical planning scenario, the X values would all be integral. In a temporal planning scenario, the X values could be real valued. Okay? But the cost itself monotonically reduces. It's a non-decreasing function. Okay? And then this is the cost of being at Phoenix. And so you have these estimates in front of you by doing both cost propagation and temporal planning. And as to how to combine them to decide which partial plan is best, you could do it in multiple ways. So the first principles way to do multi-objective optimization is to generate a huge Pareto set, which essentially says, you know, two plans, you know, if you're thinking of travel planning scenario, you know, if I give you, here is a way of going to some place which is $100 costly and you need to spend 3 hours traveling. And here is another plan which is $200 costly and you need to spend 5 hours. You say, stop. Makes no sense. You know, if I have one which is $100 and 3 hours, another is $200 and 5 hours, for most people, they won't pay more and travel longer unless the travel itself gives them more pleasure, which I think most of us are not into that. Okay, so, I mean, unless it's, I guess, one of these, the Walt Disney rides, where you pay more, you get to be on the ride longer, then maybe you do it differently. But in this case, essentially, the one plan is fully dominated by the other plan in all dimensions, so you don't want to give the second plan at all. And so, every non-dominated plan is a potential solution that some user would be interested in. And so, you want to give them the Pareto set of solutions. So that's one way of answering this. The other, of course, is if you give them too many plans, they are completely overwhelmed. So the other is to try to combine them into a single objective. So alpha times apples plus beta times oranges will be utility, and it will become much nicer. So in fact, we do it all the time. In the case of Google, you know, which I'm sure all of you are familiar with, you know, if you give a query, a page, what's a good page? A good page is one that is very relevant to your query in the sense it has, you know, terms that you are mentioning in your query, but it's also considered very important. That means lots of people think this is a good page. And how do you combine? One is apples, one is oranges. And how do you combine? You know, Google has the secret sauce where they put at alpha times, you know, the similarity plus beta times the page rank, and then they give you the answer. They could actually give all non-dominated set of pages, but I'm sure we would not be interested in looking at them. Okay, so in the case of SAPA, actually, what wind up doing, I don't know whether I have this slide, we support the model of alpha times make span plus beta times cost, where, you know, alpha, beta are user chosen. And you can support the best plan with respect to that utility function. Now, what's interesting is to actually compute the goodness of a partial plan during the search, you need to estimate its cost as well as time taken to reach the goal, and then combine them using this alpha beta. Okay, so you still need to actually propagate and combine these multiple different things on the same partial plan. Okay. The other thing that actually this brings up is in the case of, we actually had to do it in the case of SAPA too, is if you have to consider both time and cost and resources, okay, one idea is the notion of relaxation can be, cascaded set of relaxation. Okay, so for example, think about it this way. If you are thinking of, until now we just ignored negative interactions and then you kept positive interactions, that was the only relaxation we did. Okay, so if you have time and negative interactions, you can first ignore time, then you will get classical planning, then you can ignore negative interactions, okay, you will get relaxed planning graph. Okay, and the fewer things you ignore, the closer you are to the actual heuristic value for the overall problem. Okay, so in fact, when we are talking about the conformance planners, if you remember, classical planners can be used as heuristics for conformance planners. You run the classical planning algorithm, and that will, whatever it says is the value that the conformance planner can use as its heuristic. Okay, so classical planning is a relaxation of conformance planning. Okay. So once you have this staggered set of relaxations, one idea would be to go all the way down to the positive interactions alone and compute the relaxed plan for that and then start adding penalties to that relaxed plan. And I mentioned this earlier once during the positive negative interactions. You get the relaxed plan and add a penalty to handle the negative interactions. You could do this in the context of temporal planning too. You could get a relaxed plan, time-sensitive relaxed plan, and then add a penalty to take into account resource interactions if you don't actually capture the resource propagation during the planning graph. Okay, if you do capture it, then you don't have to do this as a separate piece. So again, this is another place where you can get heuristics from. Part of it is how do you get these sorts of information? Propagate everything together at one point, or you can ignore things, make a relaxed plan, and then adjust it to take the ones that you ignored earlier. Okay, that's a general design idea that seems to work. Yes, sir.
When you're saying it's easier, it's computationally more convenient to do to do temporal projection, plan graph with temporal materials in it, then you extract the relaxed plan, and then you do resource propagation only on this sub.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Okay. And again, is that the right thing to do? No. Is it a cheap thing to do? Yes. So right is not an issue in the case of heuristics, because the right thing to do would be to solve the problem and use the answer that the problem says as the heuristic for the problem again. It just makes no sense. You know, that would be a perfect heuristic, but it won't get you anywhere. So you know that the extremes are bad. You know that the right amount of time to spend on the heuristic to get the best bang for your buck is somewhere in the middle. The question is where this somewhere is. Okay. There was also, and I'm going to skip this right now, there's also work on throttle, which actually combines probabilities, the stochastic planning, and durative action. Again, two different things that we looked at two different places, but they can be combined. And they use a variation of reachability heuristics of the type. This guy is here, actually. You can yell at him later on and ask him. So that's the case. Again, the idea is you can understand how various things are propagated, and then when you talk about sets of things, then you can compute them as essentially ignore one, consider the heuristic value, and then add the other one. So that's one way of looking at it. Let me see where I can go. Okay. So let me try to start wrapping up and see so that we'll at least have a few minutes for any random questions that we can think of, that we could collectively think about answers for. So we started by saying planning graphs can actually be seen as approximate reachability analysis. And we then pointed out that the level at which something appears in the planning graph is a good measure of how far it is from the current state. Okay, and then we started finding all sorts of ways of co-opting that idea. You could consider level, you can consider level with mutual exclusion information, or you could consider level as a set in terms of the levels of the individual pieces of that set, and then the question is, do you add or take a max? And we looked at, you know, potential trade-offs in doing various of those. We considered the relaxed plan extraction, which essentially takes positive interactions into account, and we considered adding negative interactions back in by taking the relaxed plan cost plus adding some penalty to handle negative interactions. Again, this is not necessarily the end of the road. I think there are better ways of taking negative interactions into account. I just don't know them yet. Okay, and I'm sure you can figure this out. The other thing is we have considered ways of propagating not just the reachability information, which is yes, it can be done, no, it can't be done, but also cost information, which is how hard is it to do it by this level. Okay, and then we extended the notion of planning graph topology itself to consider time rather than discrete indices. Okay, that would be the idea of by this time, 4.79 seconds, can I reach this? Okay, then I can also say cost and time. By 4.79 seconds, if I can reach this literal, how costly would it be? What's the lowest cost with which I can reach this literal estimated cost by 4.79 seconds? Okay, then I also considered the idea of these literals actually being continuous valued. So where then you're going to ask, by 4.79 seconds, I can have 7.4 watts of power with $4.39. So this essentially is now, we're still talking about the same idea of optimistic projection, except you start having these bells and whistles because the underlying time and the index time is becoming real valued. It's no longer indices. And the values of the literals are no longer true and false. Okay, so that winds up adding all this stuff. And then costs are also, the actions are no longer just all uniform costs. They can have different costs. Okay, and I talked a little about how multiple of these can be put together. Now, I think I kind of did this already, but at the risk of overdoing it, the one reason why you should be interested in this sort of heuristics, planning graph reachability heuristics, is, of course, their work. I mean, in fact, there are tons of papers written on this by tons of different people showing that basically reachability heuristics based on planning graphs actually improve performance significantly. You know, pretty much most of the top class planners right now in the competition wind up using some of these ideas and variations of these. Okay. The other thing, a huge plus point, is their forgiving. Okay, so you can decide how accurate you want your heuristic to be. You could try to do, for each one of these ideas, there is a version of doing graph plan for that idea. Okay? The only difference between graph plan and this is graph plan actually tries to compute the subgraph on the planning graph that corresponds to a valid solution. This was the first thing that was done right after the graph plan paper in 95. 96, 97, you have several planners written which basically extend the graph plan idea itself to deal with time. Then there's a temporal graph plan paper, there's a probabilistic graph plan paper, there is a conditional graph plan paper, there is anything that you can think of graph plan paper. None of them work in the sense of scalability. They are all used nicely. We cite them to show that we can do better than them. That's actually a good thing to do because, you know, you have, whenever you write a new planner for, let's say, stochastic planning with continuous variables, you can always go back to the old planners which don't work, and they will provide you the enemy against which you measure your performance. But more interestingly, the reason they don't work is not because the people who wrote them, including myself, are dumb, but that's because it's because they're not forgiving. If you are trying to keep soundness, you need to make sure that, you know, you do not ever say something is mutually exclusive when it isn't. Okay? Whereas if you shift this whole thing, and then you have to make sure that you have grown the planning graph to the right level such that the subplan is actually a valid subgraph of this. And you need to make sure that you have searched for all the valid subgraphs until you find the solution. Okay. When I throw this as a heuristic phase, when I'm using the same thing but at the heuristic phase, everything is up for grabs. You know, I can decide how far to extend the planning graph. I can decide how greedy versus non-greedy I am in extracting the relaxed plan. I can decide how many considerations the relaxed plan actually captures Does it capture time, cost, resources, or does it capture one of them? Because the more it captures, the more accurate its heuristic would be. Keep the base level planner simple architecturally and throw all your hairiness into the heuristic. And it winds up actually being a huge advantage in terms of actually designing these planners. Okay. So again, as I said, if you don't like doing mutex, that's okay. Nobody is doing mutex these days. And there are winning planners don't do mutex. Now, of course, winning doesn't necessarily mean that you are the best planner that can ever be there. You know, it's until next year's planning competition when, as I pointed out, I think, in fact, an argument can be made that FF downward winds up taking more negative interaction information than FF does. And so it does better. You know, there is a room here, headroom here, to actually improve planner performance significantly more. But it's not going to be all or nothing. You can take your time trying to do it. Okay. And then, as I said, you know, they allow propagation of multiple types of information. We talked about this notion of phased relaxation, which is take a relaxed plan and add the other considerations versus propagating all the considerations at the same time. You know, again, this is an issue of, this is something that you have that you don't have if you consider doing it in a graph plan kind of an idea, where you know, imagine doing temporal planning by actually finding a classical plan and then adding time to it so that it will become correct. Can be done, but it's more hairier, okay? And then there is a bunch of other things we talked about, graph structure and just the idea of doing this sort of optimistic achievability analysis winds up supporting other uses of planning graph. For example, helpful actions is something that's a very useful thing. In fact, most planners wind up getting as much of a boost from reducing their branching factor as they do from actually reducing, by having a more accurate heuristic information. So that's something that you wind up getting because you have it anyway on the way to computing. Okay. Now, and then of course versatility, which is basically the point of this whole last God knows how many hours, there is no such thing as a single planning graph now. The planning graph is a family where they can become quite baroque, they can propagate different kinds of information. The only bedrock principle is optimistic propagation of achievability. So if I say something can't be done, it can't be done. If I say something can be done, maybe I'm right, maybe I'm not right, okay? So that's ultimately the big issue in doing these things, okay? So we looked at a variety of planning graph variations themselves, labeled temporal planning graphs and so on. We looked at different things being propagated. You can propagate levels, mutual exclusions, costs, and labels. We considered different, at least try to tell you that you could use these kinds of heuristics for different kinds of planning algorithms. I mean, planning problems, first of all. That means you try it for classical, temporal planning, stochastic planning, non-deterministic planning, oversubscription planning, partial satisfaction planning, some of them, at least. You know, so at least I showed you that the same idea, general idea, can be used for multiple different problems. And it can also be used for multiple different planning algorithms. You know, in the back of my mind, in the back of all your minds too, probably, you're thinking of progression search all the time. But I did mention earlier that you could use the same thing for regression search. You can also use it for partial order planning. And there are good reasons to believe that some of those planners will actually come back into vogue, sooner or later. One thing, in fact, I think was asked during the break, and I could probably mention that now, is most of these heuristics, most of the current day planners actually are ground planners. That means they think in terms of ground action instances. Okay. Now, before this improvement in speed came along, the planners used to be lifted. They used to think in terms of partial plans where you say, put A from something onto B. I don't really care where A is. Pick A, wherever it is, put it on B. Now, graph plan and all these other planners that we've been grown to get in love with don't know how to say that. They say, move A from C to B, move A from Z to B, move A from D to B. Okay. Now, it looks as if this is not a big issue. You can always ground the domain out in the pre-processing step and then start. Many people who actually, from outside of the planning community, who tried to apply one of the classical, one of the, you know, planning computation winning planners to their problem, find that the pre-processing step, the planner dies because they just weigh too many groundings. Okay? That's not good. You know, we could say that as soon as you're done with your pre-processing step, I have this really powerful heuristic, you know, which uses the state-of-the-art planning concepts and, you know, we'll get you a solution, but they're not going to be happy. Now, if you do not want to commit, and if you want to be able to solve problems with actions with partial bindings, you would not do that in forward direction. It's not natural to do it in forward direction. It's very natural to do it in the goal direction. So start from the goals. The reason I would have said move A from something to B is because I had a goal on AB, and I know that move A from something to B will have the effect I need, which is on AB. And that's something I don't care about. You will figure that out as part of your plan. So going in the backward direction actually helps. I mean, so if you wind up looking at lifted planning problems, then backward direct, goal-directed planners and, you know, partial order planners wind up being quite important. And I have not talked too much about how would the heuristics change, if they change at all, with respect to that sort of, you know, when the planners are doing lifted planning. In fact, there are two possible ways of doing it. One is you could still stick with ground planning graphs, and yet support lifted planning at the base level. That's the easiest thing I would do if I'm going to write the paper for next ICAST. Okay? But it would be more interesting to actually try to think about versions of planning graphs that actually are lifted. And it should not be that hard. What winds up happening is you will wind up having these literals which are variableized, and you have a bunch of constraints between these variables. So the proposition list now will truly become a constraint set. Each proposition list is a constraint set. And you can decide how to relax the solving of those constraints. Okay? So again, I'm talking at the edge of my understanding, but I think the direction itself of how to deal with lifted actions is something that we gave up along the way. You know, it was something, it is important for, you know, for most people. They don't consider all the ground actions in most applications. Okay, so that's something that, and if you do that, you know, many of these other planners, which, you know, you don't seem to hear too much about partial order and regression planners nowadays, but they can very well wind up being the only game in town. Because think of what does it mean to search forward using partially instantiated actions. My head hurts to think about it. Whereas I can easily think about what it means to do search backward using partially instantiated actions. Okay. So that's, I guess, the sort of things that I wanted to mention, and we have questions here.
So the difference is that the one that does that is UNPOP. And but UNPOP has a it does regression to build its plan graph.
So the planner that he mentioned, in fact, I should, for the completeness sake, and that's also a very good idea. So this idea of reachability information in planning graph, reachability information being used as heuristics for planning has a long history. I just concentrated on the planning graph as a data structure. If you go back to the paper, written paper, it talks about a bunch of people who have tried it in very different circumstances before. Okay, one which actually is still around is Drew McDermott's paper, which I think it's called, is it called UNPOP? Or is it the PEDEST? I mean, it's called
UNPOP.
UNPOP.
Is the successor to PEDEST.
Yeah. So the thing that Drew McDermott does is you can think of what he does as computing the cost of a set of goals on demand. Okay, so what we have in this talk is given, you just think of the simple classical planning problem. I have the initial state, I compute the planning graph, the planning graph is standing in attention, and then when I have a set of goals whose cost I need to find out, you know, if you're doing level-based, you just index into the first level where all of them occur. That's as simple as that. Okay, if you're doing sum, you pick the values of the levels at which they appear and add them up. If you do relaxed plan, you spend a little bit more time. What Drew McDermott does is different. He starts with the set of goals that you are computing, that you are trying to estimate the cost of. And these could have variables if you want. Okay? And what he does is he's doing approximate regression planning. Okay, so he allows partially instantiated actions to come to support individual goals. So if I have G1, G2, G3, he almost tries to compute by regression individual costs of supporting G1, G2, G3 separately. Okay, and then add them up. In supporting G1, if G1 is on AB, he would wind up considering move A from X to B as one of the actions in his backward analysis. Okay, and so there are two places where he cuts corners. If you do full regression planning, then you're just not going to be able to get good heuristic cost in terms of cost of computational heuristic. One is he basically makes this independence assumption upfront that if there are goals G1, G2, G3 that you're trying to compute the cost of, you look at regression for each of them separately. That's one point. The second point is when there are, you know, suppose you wind up, as you're doing this, you're trying to support G1 and, you know, you added one action and which is move A from X to B, and then it all of a sudden has preconditions which are partially instantiated. Okay, so A is on X is a precondition now. So suddenly you will start winding up having situations where you have multiple partially instantiated sub-goals whose cost you have to estimate because you're trying to estimate a single top-level goal's cost. Now, their value, their cost would depend on the value of X. Even if you just say, I want to compute each of them separately, it still depends on the values of X and Y. What the other greedy assumption he makes, he assumes that he will look for the best unifier and just stick to that unifier and split the goal, you know, split the sub-goals up into individual pieces. So he's computing ultimately the cost of the ground goals, but because there are variables, he needs to decide how many unifications he's going to consider. That, you know, the accurate way to do it would be to consider all possible matchings with the initial state. Okay, and he just considers the matching that will make the most number of these sub-goals unify with the initial state currently as it is, and then stick to that and use that as the basis for computing the cost. Okay, it's an interesting way. You can think of this approach as essentially demand-driven reachability analysis. And whereas the planning graph, in essence, does upfront a large amount of work so that runtime you will compute reachability information almost faster. And there are some interesting, there should be some interesting alternatives between them. But because he does this demand-driven and starts from goals, he does have this advantage of thinking in terms of partially instantiated action. Okay, he has a very nice paper in AI Journal, which, and in fact, the original paper, and this is greedy regression graph. That's what he calls it. And in the original paper is in 96 AIPS. Okay, and again, I think that will have its day in. Understand when regression and basically goal-directed planning becomes more important. Any other questions? Okay. If we have no more questions, thanks for your patience. And we're done. And I am recorded all of this stuff, and I'm going to put this on the web. And if you play it backwards, you will know who is the secret of winning the planning competition. So, that's it. Thanks.